This is XTP Media.
This episode of Extended is dedicated to the memory of Captain Jennifer Casey of the Canadian Forces Snowbirds. Our thoughts are with her family, friends, and colleagues during this difficult time.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Takeoff. So, here are your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 100 of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Today, I'm joined by Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society, and Tim is the Editor-in-Chief of Aerospace Magazine. Tim, how are you today?
I'm very well, thank you. Yeah, good to be here.
Yeah, good to be here. And Gareth Stringer, Editor at Global Aviation Resource, how are you today?
I'm good, thanks. Have we really done this introduction 100 times? That's amazing.
Didn't think of that, actually. Didn't think of that, yeah. Well,
absolutely amazing.
It's evolved. I wouldn't recommend going back to listening to some of our early episodes, but yeah, we have 100. We got two features today, but of course we're here to celebrate our 100th show. Talk about our favourite episodes and talk a little bit about what's happened in the last 8 years and maybe in the next 8 years. So 100 episodes, we've talked to pilots, aircrew, engineers, astronauts, movers and shakers in the aviation industry, authors, enthusiasts, historians, restoration specialists, we could go on. We've been really lucky to have so many of them in the last 8 years. So let's take a look back at maybe some of our moments, things that have happened in the industry, and what the last 8 years have meant to us. Gareth, let me come to you first. What do you do when you look back over the last 8 years? And apart from talk about 100 intros,
it wasn't a criticism. It's
no,
just
it
like,
is.
Oh my God, we've sat down and done this 100 times.
Yeah,
and eight years ago, if anyone had said 8 years later you'll be recording your 100th episode, that just would have seemed quite bizarre.
Yeah, I think. I don't think I would have thought that.
We know that, you know, podcasts and things like that can be quite sort of transient, can't they? They come and go and they, you know, they appear, disappear, new ones come up. But here we are 8 years and 100 years later. And I've got to say, because I don't know if you guys were going to say it, so I will. Get your tissues out, folks. I think the first thing to say is that we wouldn't have done it if it wasn't, you know, for the sort of chemistry and the fact that the three of us get on and enjoy doing this so well. And I think that's quite important to say, to be honest, because for those of you listening who don't know, I mean, Tim, Peter and I have only ever really met each other a couple of times. You know,
I don't think we've ever been in the same room together.
Right. Which should be something to try and achieve before episode 200. But you know, fundamentally you've got to want to keep putting these shows together, making the time to record them and enjoy doing it. And I think the fact, you know, the three of us do that and enjoy each other's company on here and get on well and share the same interests is at the heart of it, because it just wouldn't have ever happened otherwise. I think that's probably fair to say.
Yeah,
the second thing I wrote down was the guests, because as you've just, you know, alluded to, Peter, we've had some incredible guests on here. I know that, Tim will concur with this. He will have interviewed some fantastic people for his day job, and I've interviewed some fantastic people for Global Aviation Resource and other bits and pieces along the way. But it's for extended. I've got to do some things that will really live long in the memory. You know, I interviewed a shuttle astronaut. You know, I interviewed Andrew Smith, who's written one of my favorite ever books about the moon landings. Roland White has been here. He's nearly done as many shows as we have. He's absolutely fantastic. You know, there was there was Dan. You know, I'm just looking through the episode list. You know, Dan Snow for the Dam Busters. There's, you know, Eric Winkle Brown. There was, I mean, there's just been so much Royal Air Force people, airline pilots, you name it. We've interviewed them, and that is at the heart of the show, isn't it? The guests that you have on, and as I will go on to next, what we talk about is what's made the show for me. The subject matter has been brilliant. It's been so varied. Peter, you deserve massive credit for coming up with a lot of these ideas and stitching the whole thing together.
thanks.
And I think the other thing is that I feel like I've learned so much from doing this as well. And I've genuinely found it really, really interesting and educational. And I think, and hopefully, and my last point is joins in with that. It's really good fun. And hopefully that's what our listeners would think about us, that they're going to listen to this because they're interested in aviation. They'll hopefully learn something as they listen to it, but hopefully they enjoy it as well. We don't take it too seriously. We don't take ourselves too seriously. Yes, we've talked about some serious subjects, and yeah, it's been plenty of tragedies and things to discuss along the way as well. That is the nature of the beast, but fundamentally it's been really good fun. And you know, I know we don't always get together as often as we would like to, or even, you know, with all three of us as we'd like to. There's a lot of life gone on in 8 years as well, so that has a tendency to get in the way. But fundamentally that's what it means to me. And you know, I feel like we should be giving ourselves a pat on the back tonight. I think 100 episodes is pretty damn good going.
No, hear, hear. I think that's a good shout. How about you, Tim? What's your view on the last 8 years?
What happened? I don't know. I'm news at the moment. Aviation news at the moment is in the past couple of years it's coming so fast. You literally can't kind of keep up. Where there's one things that would have dominated the headlines for, you know, at least a year. You know, in the past 8 years, it's there, bang, and it's gone for a day. So, but yeah. I agree with Gareth. I mean, looking at the going through all the people we had on the show, it's like amazing. You know, we had Tim Peake, we had Winkle, you know, some of these sort of, you know, Dave Bio Baranek, you know, flew in Top Gun, A350 test pilots, really, really amazing, you know, and I mean, Andrew Smith for Moondust, really just sort of amazing people to have on the show, and, you know, authors that we know and love, you know, and you're like, oh, how, you know, you're reading his book, you know, Roland White or Paul Beaver, and wow, I've got him on the show, you know, or Sharky Ward. I mean, who would have thought I'd be talking to
Sharky Ward in the Caribbean? Ward, you know?
Britain's last air race. I mean, he's basically, you know, Britain's last air race, and, you know, having him on the show, giving his views, it's kind of crazy to think about.
Yeah,
well, you know, we're a little kind of show, and we get these people on. So thanks to all our guests for coming on and chatting with us.
I'm
cheating a bit because I'm looking at them, but favorite episode title, episode 66, A Roland White Christmas. Genius.
Yeah, that was your marketing experience rising to the fore there. I did note that one as I was running through it, because we were contemplating what to call this episode, weren't we? Have you got any good ideas for that then, Gareth? You must have one. You must have one in the chamber. Come on.
No, you've put me under pressure now, because I actually haven't. I have been pondering it. was wondering if we would get like a patch made up, like, you know, pilots have like 1,000 hours.
Yes!
We should get like a 100 pods.
Yeah. Yes.
Or like, was it 100 missions over Vietnam?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then you can retire.
The bloody 100th. What about the bloody 100th?
Yeah. Well, my first thought was 100 not out, just to celebrate the fact that A, we've done it, and B, we're still here.
Yeah. And that's the thing. I think the point you made about, you know, we enjoy it and we keep going. And sometimes it's not quite as serious as some people maybe like some of these programs to be. But we set out when we started this to be diverse. And I think, to be fair, I think we've covered almost every aspect of the aerospace industry. I mean, we've done ballooning, gliding, as Tim was saying, test pilots, fighter pilots, airline pilots, astronauts. You know, we've done the spectrum, but there's still so many stories to tell. And I think not a day goes by when I don't think, oh, that sounds like a good angle to take. I wonder if we could do that. And I come up with lots of lists that I circulate. I never stick to any of them, by the way. But there's always somebody who comes along and you think, God, they're too good not to talk to. You know, they've got a great story to tell. And sometimes when I look back at some of our guests who are actually not the maybe the media giants that some of the names you mentioned there have been. And some of the feedback we've had on episodes, we did an episode of the chap who was in the very first 747 air crash, a guy called Earl Morehouse, very early on.
Yeah.
And bizarrely, that one stuck with a lot of people. When I bump into people or talk to them, that's one of the episodes that comes up because it sort of had a bit of an eerie nature to it. But yeah, just amazing people. Frank Chapman, the A350 test pilot, he sticks in my mind. The guy who wrote Anthony Fokker's life story, Mark Derricks. I actually dreaded doing that interview. Hope he's not listening, by the way. I actually dreaded doing that interview because I just wasn't really into it. But I was absolutely fascinated by the guy, and the episode, I don't think, had the greatest number of downloads, but got some really good traction. And when I look back, I think, do you know what? Some of the episodes as they stand alone are a lot more powerful than I thought they ever would be in their own rights. And as you said, you know, everything from Dan Snow to, you know, Andrew Smith, Tim Peake. It's just amazing. And I've got to say, because both of you two have interviewed astronauts, two of my favourite interviews are Tim Peake and Mike Mullane. I've got to say, I love Mike Mullane.
that was like that's like a dream come true, and I don't say that lightly, but you know, I didn't think when I read his book that I would ever get the chance to speak to him, you know. And when you send the email off, you know, kind of with your fingers crossed, thinking, I wonder if I'll get a reply, when somebody like him comes back and says, God, I'd be delighted to talk to you, you know. That was a big deal, and he was brilliant. He was absolutely brilliant.
That was awesome. I'm just trying to look for the episode number, actually. I can't remember what episode
I've got them in front of me, actually. It was episode 20. It was astronaut Mike Mullane, Roland White, and Gene McCulker.
Wow, that's a pretty decent lineup.
Yeah,
that's a pretty decent lineup. And the other thing, I don't know about you guys, you'd done a lot more of this before I had, is how humble most of our guests are. The amazing things they've done and the awe that certainly I often put them in, they're so humble and they're so decent and easy to talk to. It's made the job so much easier to have people like that on the show. And I'm trying to remember, apart from the things we have a laugh about, I don't think there have been too many big egos walk through the door either, which in an industry like this is quite interesting.
It's been great, hasn't it? It's been good fun. And listen, I don't know about you, but you know, even this week we've been chatting on our WhatsApp group with some ideas for future episodes. All right, some of them might be a bit ambitious, but equally there's things like we're recording this on the night, obviously, that NASA and SpaceX are due to launch. We've probably been talking about that project for the best part of 8 years. It's incredible, really, to see the development of some of these things, isn't it? As we've been talking about them. So as you said, Peter, there's always more stories to for people to tell and for us to pass on and be the sort of conduit to pass them on to other people. And let's keep it going if we can.
Yeah, let's crack on. So why don't we look at the first of our features for this 100th episode? Gareth, why don't you take us all the way back to episode one?
Yeah, I mean, this sort of squares the circle, doesn't it, fantastically. So for those of you that don't remember or weren't around or haven't checked it out, episode one featured John Bond, Bondi, and at the time I interviewed him, he was the 2012 Royal Air Force Tucano display pilot. He was an instructor at RAF Linton on Ouse and was about to embark on his on a display season in the Tucano advanced trainer, now retired.
That's another incredibly thing that's changed.
Linton on Ouse is closing. You know, extraordinary. But hey ho. So we thought, wouldn't it be cool to get Bondi back on? Even more so that for episode 100, he's now a pilot in the Royal Air Force aerobatic team, the Red Arrows. And all right, nobody's done a great deal of flying this summer, but if he does get to do any, he's one of the synchro pilots. He's synchro lead as well. So here's Bondi, eight years and 99 episodes later. And so 8 years later, 99 episodes later, welcome back to the show, Flight Lieutenant John Bond. Bondi, how are you?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Does it feel like 8 years? I mean, where has that gone, for a start?
There's a lot of water under the bridge, yeah. It's gone very, very quickly. Quite literally flown by. I mean, the experiences that I've had in those 8 years have been pretty spectacular, some of them. Obviously, joining the Reds, going to the front line, post the Tucano display year. It's been action-packed.
So, let's go back 8 years. When I interviewed you for episode one of this podcast, you were about to embark on your first season as the Tucano, or your season as Tucano display pilot, 2012 air show season. And I just saw this morning, actually, courtesy of Facebook and its memories, yesterday, I believe, that you made your debut at the Abingdon Air Show.
Well, this used to be. I hadn't quite picked that one up.
What are your memories of that season? Presumably, part of what happened there and how you felt about it led to where you are now.
Yeah, it was. You know, it was an amazing thing to do at such an early stage of my Air Force and flying career. Obviously, I'd done my own training through Valley and Linton, and then post Valley, I went back to be an instructor on the Tucano at Linton. Did 2 or 3 years instructing, and then was very lucky enough to apply and get selected for the display job in 2012. And, you know, for I can't even remember how old I was there, probably about 26, 27, to go and do that, you know, at an early stage of my career was a real privilege. And, you know, the amount of freedom and the amount of sort of responsibility I got given at that early stage, you know, I'll be forever grateful for, because that has, you know, given me the experience, you know, to take forward onto the front line and into the Reds. And the season itself was amazing. I mean, you don't often get to, you know, have a small team that you're pretty much on your own to make your own decisions, you know, weather decisions, logistical decisions, etc., to make the displays work. And, you know, you get given that team for 6-7 months of the year, and, you know, you're away every weekend, sometimes displays during the week, and you get given that responsibility, and, you know, you're pretty much autonomous as an operating platform. And, you know, you learn a lot very, very quickly. And, you know, there are some times that I had some difficult decisions to make weather-wise or operational-wise. And, you know, an early stage of a flying career, to be given the trust by the seniors to be able to make those, hopefully stood me in good stead for what would happen later.
And one thing we must just mention is, of course, that in this intervening period of 8 years, the Tucano's actually retired. Is you know, no longer in Royal Air Force service. A quick word about an aircraft that you obviously got to know very, very well.
Yeah, it was the first real sort of single seat, you know, trainer that I flew that didn't have anyone sitting next to you. You know, you could effectively be on your own, even though you're in a two-seat aeroplane with an instructor behind you. You know, if you just blank them out for a minute, then you could pretty much be on your own. So, you know, it's the first real taste of being a fighter pilot and the skills that go with that. And the aeroplane was, you know, it was simple to fly, but to fly well, it took a little bit of hand-eye coordination. It, you know, had big torque effect with the propeller. You needed a lot of rudder in some manoeuvres. And actually, to fly the aeroplane well, it did take a bit of getting used to. And for the guys coming through, it was, it was easy enough for them to cope with, but, you know, not too easy that when you go to the Hawk, it'll be a completely different step up. So actually, I found the biggest gap was going from the Tutor to the Tucano rather than the Tucano to the Hawk. You know, okay, the Hawk doesn't have a propeller and it goes a bit faster, but the cockpit is pretty much the same. So actually, as a platform stepping up, it was good. Obviously, we've got the Texan now, and you know, the Texan to the T2, the Hawk T2 is, you know, I guess going to be pretty similar as well. So, you know, we've gone from, you know, Tucano to Hawk T2, which I can probably imagine is maybe a bigger step in a way than the Tucano to the Hawk T1, because the cockpit is so different. But obviously, I didn't go that route. It would be interesting to hear what the guy had to say about that. But, you know, the Tucano Hawk T1 was a very well-trodden path, and I think that worked very well for the Air Force.
Yeah, job done for the Tucano, definitely. Yeah, as you've already alluded to, you had that kind of double-edged sword at the end of your training. You were streamed, obviously, FastJet and went to Valley, but then you were creamed back to be an instructor at Linton, which, you know, I guess at that point everybody wants to get to the front line, but it is an honour to be chosen to do that, and you wouldn't have become the Tucano display pilot if that hadn't happened. But you did get to the front line, and I remember asking you, possibly the first time I met you at Linton, where you wanted to go, and you definitely wanted to go Typhoon, and that's where you ended up.
Yeah, again, you know, this game is all about, and what I've learned over, you know, the almost 15 years in the Air Force is that, you know, this game's all about timing. You know, had I not been creamed, then I would have gone to the front line. But actually, at that time, they were the only OCU that was open was the Tornado GR4. Typhoon wasn't taking anyone at that time. So, actually, you know, being creamed off probably put me in a better time frame bracket to go to the Typhoon. And you know, it's not so much, you know, what you can do. It's whereabouts on the timescale you are that get you the jobs, and that's what I've learned throughout this game. Timing is everything. So I was very lucky to time it right that actually there weren't any Tornado GR4 slots when I finished eventually at Linton, or there weren't any at that particular time as the Tornado seemed to be drawing down. And actually the Typhoon was you know, needed lots slots filling, so managed to get myself a slot there, and had an amazing 4 years.
Just reading through your biog on the Red Arrows site, and from knowing you as I do, I mean, you had a pretty incredible 4 years, didn't you? You did so much in that tour on the front line.
I did, you know, pretty much did every exercise and op that was going on the Typhoon at the time. And again, that's timing again. It's just the squadron cycle and what squadron does what. You know, so I was very lucky again, timing wise, on three fighter squadron at Coningsby. Yeah, pretty much day one of finishing the OCU and being on the squadron, we were out to Abu Dhabi for a violent tactical leadership course out in the UAE, So that was my first week on a new frontline squadron. It's a very, very baby pilot in completely new airspace in a completely new jet, which was an interesting 6 weeks, but, you know, thoroughly enjoyable. And, you know, that was an amazing welcome to frontline flying. And then throughout the 4 years, it just got better, really. I mean, we did Baltic Air Policing, the first time they'd done that since sort of the early 2000s out in Lithuania at Cholet, and I believe I've just gone back this year as well. And then into an exercise in Malaysia with the Singaporeans and the Malaysians. And then we went back out to the UAE to do the same course as I did when I first started. Red Flag, an amazing experience that was. Huge exercise over in Nevada, and then eventually went on operations out in the Middle East, which is what every frontline pilot joins up for. And I was so pleased that I got to do that towards the end of my tour with Typhoon. And, you know, obviously in between that, it's you know, the main event of the Typhoon is protecting, you know, the UK's airspace. So QRA, Quick Reaction Alert, formed a large part of the in-between of the exercises and the operations, and also down in the Falklands as well. I did a couple of stints down there for 6 or so weeks. So, you know, looking back on it, it was a very busy time. I think I was away 4 to 5 months of each year, if you add it all up. But, you know, the experience that you gain, the experiences that you have operating with different nationalities and operating in different environments with a very capable aeroplane, you know, has to be up there with the pinnacle of your career.
And I guess we must just mention, because I don't think it's a secret now, eagle-eyed viewers will have seen you in a film for Sky News, which really was the first time, I think, that the sort of curtain was pulled behind a little bit to give us a glimpse of how QRA works. I mean, that must have been quite exciting in itself.
Yeah, exactly that. I mean, it came as a bit of a surprise. I can remember it quite clearly. I think I'd just come off a couple of weeks leave. As you can notice, I'm quite tanned.
Just what you needed.
Yeah, you notice I'm quite tanned, I think. So I'd just come off, and I got wind, I think, of something happening just before I went on leave, and I didn't really envy that I was on that shift that the Sky News team were there. So again, that was just pure luck that, well, luck or whatever, but that they had rocked up and they were going to do a piece on QRA, which I thought was a great idea, because, you know, I know a lot of people who aren't sort of particularly familiar with what we do, that, you know, that would be a great thing to put on TV and, you know, let everyone know what goes on. However, I didn't quite realise it would get so much coverage. I get obviously now being on the Reds, and, you know, my actual name being out there. I think they advertised as Flight Lieutenant John.
That's right, Christian name.
Probably not
only
the trying to keep the offset there, but you know, obviously now people realise that this person on the Sky News documentary from 5 years ago looks quite similar to the guy that's on the Red Arrows now. So I got rumbled pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And actually the amount of messages I get on Instagram or Twitter about that Sky News documentary, I guess they must put it on every now and again as a repeat, or I think it's on YouTube as well.
It is definitely on YouTube. Yeah.
You know, the amount of people that I get recognizing me from that documentary rather than anything else is quite bizarre. I didn't quite expect it to get the coverage, but Sky did a great job on that, actually. And, you know, they didn't sort of fantasize it that much, you know, they didn't over egg it and dramatize it like it could have been.
It was well put together, wasn't it? Very well put together.
Yeah, it was. It was very, and you know, that was, you know, something I think me and Shippers who were on it together, who I was at Linton with as well, you know, I think we were quite proud of that sort of outcome and how that came across. So, you know, hopefully that did a little bit of, to educate on, you know, what QRA is and how important it is to the defence of the UK.
So was it inevitable that you were going to apply for the Red Arrows, or was there a point when and I'm sure we might have talked about this 8 years ago, but I can't remember, but was it something you always had in mind?
It was. I think, you know, it's one of those that stays very firmly in the back of your mind, you know, through the initial stage of training, because obviously it's so long away, and the experience you've got to build up in order to be in a position to apply, you know, it's going to take 8 to 10 years most probably. So I think it was, you know, it's one of the things. I remember watching air shows with my parents as a kid and watching the Red Arrows, and, you know, you'd never really know who the guy in the cockpit was. It was one of those strange, you know, is this guy an astronaut, or, you know, who gets to be a Red Arrow? Do you know? It's very surreal in the fact that it's not that normal, and, you know, there's only 9 pilots that can, you know, can do it each year. So it's one of those that I just sort of parked, and, you know, it'd be amazing to do, and trying to find out how you become one. But, you know, I sort of parked it pretty much until I did the display season at Linton. Again, I got, you know, put amongst all these incredibly talented guys that were displaying 9 jets, and, you know, were at the same shows that I was. And, you know, like, oh, right, okay, you know, got to know the guys, and, you know, got to learn a little bit about, I've actually flew with them as well, and got to learn a little bit about what goes into it. And I thought, you know, maybe after the completion of my frontline tour, then, you know, I can put my hat in the ring. So that's how it came across, really. And I applied three times actually. The first time was it was my first year on the Typhoon, so that was never gonna happen. But sort of just register my interest. Second time I got shortlisted, and wasn't successful after the shortlist. But on the third application, I got shortlisted, and was very lucky to get a place. So bit of a progression there, from sort of getting a taster of it in 2012, displaying the Tucano, to, you know, undertaking a really good, fulfilling frontline tour, to doing, I think, what is the pinnacle of anyone's flying career who is that way inclined. You know, some people it just doesn't interest them, and it's not for them. But certainly for me, it's the pinnacle of my flying career.
This is Extended, the ETOPS Aviation Podcast.
I think so. Certainly those of us who are based in the UK, we were able to follow your first season and the build up to it and into it on a pretty well made documentary here in the UK. And I remember sitting and watching it and listening to some of the things you were saying. And I think the main thing that came out of that for me at the beginning, I mean, it's bloody hard, Bondi, isn't it?
Yeah, it's hard, but it's different, which I'd say is probably the key. I mean, formation on the front line, and, you know, you learn formation from day one of flying training, pretty much, on your first course. But formation there is a means to an end. It's a means to getting in and out of airfields in poor weather, when maybe you haven't got a radar or whatever. You know, you have to stick to someone else's wing, and literally, it doesn't matter how pretty it looks, as long as you stay in formation through cloud and land the aeroplane, it does not matter how it looks, as long as it's safe. Whereas here, it needs to look good. You know, we're on public display the whole time. You know, there's no hiding. And the formation needs to look good. And in order to look good, we need to suddenly change the technique as to how we fly when we're just doing formation on the front line. You know, if number 8 or 9, who are right on the outside of the formation, turn when the boss turns, then, you know, the formation's going to look awful, because it'll effectively just look like a massive slinky. So effectively 8 or 9, and the further you're out from the boss, you have to turn before the leader turns, in order to make it, you know, all look one nice shape. For everyone to stay in the same bit of sky. So that technique, and we call it flying by ear rather than flying by eye, because everything is done off the boss's voice and his intonation. If we're simply looking at the boss, then we could be what we call well behind it, and it looked like a broken chair. So effectively, you know, as 8 and 9 or even if in big battle is 6 or 7 on the wing, you have to go before the boss even calls coming left or right. So it's really important that you're concentrating which way the boss is going to go next, if he hasn't already said, right, we're going to come left now, because you need to be gone before the boss has even said the L or the R of left or right, in order for the whole wing to move as one. And that skill takes a lot of getting used to, and that's why the winter training is so long. It's 6 months, because the new guys, if you've never done this sort of formation before, you know, have to completely undo anything they've learned previously and now learn just to go with one single input on a command. You know, that input might be wrong, it might be slightly off, but the worst thing you can do is then make a massive correction to try and get back in formation. If you just hold that input, actually, it's easier for other guys on outside of you to hold on. So you can't sort of thrash around to try and get into, you know, the perfect formation position, because the guy outside of you is going to have a torrid time trying to maintain it as well.
Were there points where you genuinely thought, am I going to be able to do this, or am I going to be able to do this well enough?
I think that's natural. And I think, you know, Starkey, who joined with me as well, we both had these discussions on a daily basis. Like, we just don't, you know, can we actually do this? You know, it's all very well looking forward to the summer, but it's like, are we actually going to be able to do it? I think you realise quite quickly, I think after the first month and a half, that actually I've got half a chance here of being able to crack this. But then you just, then things start get added. You start doing the second half manoeuvres. You think, like, oh, rollbacks. Like, am I going to be able to do the dreaded rollback? And actually, you know, it's one of those things. As soon as you've done it once, you think, right, okay, it might not be very pretty, it might not be very good, but I could probably, after another month of training, make it look half decent and be safe at it. So it's a bit terrifying at first, and there is always that doubt, right, am I going to be able to crack this? But you just need to keep persevering. There is plenty of opportunity, plenty of training time, and you sort of need to remind yourself actually why you've been selected as well, that, you know, you've got this experience behind you, so, you know, have a bit of confidence, trust yourself, and, you know, that you can do it. All right, it's not going to look pretty at first, but, you know, you'll get there with the amount of training that you get given.
Let's just stick on the theme of progression for a minute. Once you get into the team, and you start to get that first year under your belt, maybe you can tell me at what point this becomes something in front of mind, or whether it's when you join. But when do you start thinking, God, I want to be in synchro for year 2 and 3?
Do you know what? It didn't really cross my mind until sort of the end of, you know, halfway through the actual display season itself, when people started talking about next year's team. I think the first year is such a whirlwind of emotions, and it, you know, especially in my first year in 2018 with the accident, you sort of don't, I don't think it ever really crossed my mind what I'd be doing in year two. I thought it was right, just get through year one, you know, be decent as your role as number two, and then think about what's going to happen after. I think you just want to get through your first season without any massive scares or faux pas, and then think about the next. You know, obviously synchro is whatever you want to do, you know, and for me it is a bit bittersweet, obviously not having, you know, a real sort of oppo to come into, you know, with Starkey having joined me, and then him not being able to complete the season himself. See, Lingy came back, which was great, and Lingy was fantastic as three, and myself and Lingy got on really well, and I think formed quite a good team as 2 and 3. You know, obviously year two was going to be different. We'd have to get someone in to replace Lingy, well, Starkey, but Lingy as well. So it was all a bit of a roller coaster. I never really got to sort of think about what was going to happen in year two. And then obviously when that got announced that I'll be synchro from probably pretty much a cast of one, it was, you know, obviously I was absolutely delighted, and you know, synchro is probably, you know, the most exhilarating flying could probably get in the Air Force, if you're that way inclined. So again, very lucky.
You've alluded to the fact that there's obviously a tragic accident at the start, quite near the start of your introduction to the Red Arrows. I mean, that must have been hard to bounce back from, or certainly a horrendous sort of bump in the road that must have caused everybody to stop and have a good think about where they were and what they were doing, I guess. But you did bounce back. You've had all we're doing this interview in the middle of a pandemic, which is really bizarre. You know, there are no air shows planned in the near future, and we don't know what's going to happen. But you have already had some incredible positive experiences, and again, we were lucky enough to see this on TV. The trip to North America, Bondi, was just, I mean, it was an enormous success, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, the biggest tour that the Red Arrows have undertaken probably ever, and the biggest tour we'll do in a generation. So it was very, very special to be part of, and I was very pleased that, you know, we had a film crew with us to document it, mainly just for me to look back in 20, 30 years time and say, oh, try and remember, because it went so quickly. It was such a blur that before we knew it, we were back home at Scampton. You know, it was that on the go all the time that it's nice now to have something that has documented it and we can actually remember some of the times. But, you know, we went out there after, you know, a pretty much full first half of the season. Had a couple of weeks off and then came back in the beginning of August, raring to go to, you know, cross the pond, which is arguably the most challenging part of the whole tour.
Yeah.
And coming back as well. And then I could, you know, the relief when we landed in Canada, I think from everyone was quite palpable. And, you know, and then from then on, the tour just accelerated away from us. You know, we were on the road every couple of days, different airfields. I think we visited 19 different states, 22 displays, probably that plus 10 again in flypasts. And, you know, it was an incredible experience, and incredibly to put the sort of red, white and blue of the Best of British out across the pond as well. And we know they hold their military in such regard. And hopefully, you know, they saw what we could do, and, you know, I know for a fact that they welcomed us with open arms as well, which we'll be forever grateful for. You know, hopefully they saw, you know, a little bit what we're about, and, you know, and I know they welcomed us into both America and Canada incredibly well and incredibly generously. And I think that's 10 weeks that none of us will forget. Yes, at times it was very tiring. It was, you know, your new hotel every night, and, you know, as good as that sounds, you know, when you're not in your own bed and a different bed every night, you know, that fatigue becomes quite cumulative. And, you know, the fly paths were, you know, incredibly high profile. We were over places in the US that I don't think even their national teams, sort of the Thunderbirds and the Blue Angels, you know, get to do very often. And they're allowing a team from, you know, another country to come and do it, which, you know, we felt very privileged and honoured to be able to do. But, you know, it also sort of enabled us to realise that, you know, how high a regard the Red Arrows are held across the world as well. For the trust to be given to us to fly over, you know, down the Hudson River, across baseball stadiums, you know, fly past Washington DC with, you know, Pentagon, White House, you know, literally half a mile left, right track, Niagara Falls, you know, Hollywood sign. There's so many iconic images and pictures. Trying to make a photo album was impossible this year. You know, and to be allowed access to all of that airspace, you know, was something I don't think we quite realised how important and privileged that would be until it had all been completed. To be able to look back on photos and memories from that, I think, is quite special. And, you know, we were flying the flag abroad for you know, Great Britain and industry, military, businesses, and to inspire hopefully some future engineers, pilots, whatever it may be. So for us to be able to put that on a global stage is something quite special.
Well, look, we're gonna leave it there. I think that's a really good place to end it. You kind of just summed up beautifully kind of what it's all about in terms of what you're doing now. You know, it's not just about sticking nine guys in jets and having a bit of fun, is it? There's a proper reason behind what you guys are doing, and I'm sure I speak for everybody when I say I hope you can be doing it again soon, because you know, it's a big industry within itself, and you'll have seen that in the Reds and and your time on the Tucano as well. And there's a lot of people who will be looking forward to those events. Maybe we can get a few in this season. Bondi, thanks so much for joining us again. Don't know where we'll be in another 8 years, but
we'll see.
But we really appreciate you taking the time. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Take care.
Great interview, Gareth. The thing that sticks to me listening to John there is how level-headed he is. Now, the question I want to ask is that because he's a Red Arrows pilot, or is that because he was chosen to be a Red Arrows pilot because he's so cool?
Or is it because he came on the show early in his career, and that kind of mentally prepared him for a high flying career? I think we should be taking credit here.
I did
cut it out of the interview, but yes, he did mention that when he made it.
He owes it all to us.
I've known Bondi for over 8 years now, I first met him when he became the Tucano display pilot, and obviously, you know, I spoke to him recently for the interview, and I will just say he is a very, very level-headed guy, and all those attributes that saw him make his way through his RAF training, the fact that he was then creamed off to be an instructor at Linton and subsequently then chosen to be the Tucano display pilot, you know, have all served him very well through his time on the front line. And then to him eventually, it was the second or third time of asking, making it into the Red Arrows. And that's just what he's like. And, it's one of these sort of ordinary people doing ordinary things. I think we even had an episode called that at one point. But what you hear with him is what you get. That's him. Yeah.
Okay. Let's take a quick break, and then we're going to listen to Mick Oakey from the Aviation Historian.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. We will bring you multimedia, lectures and discussion from inside the world of aviation, aeronautics and space. If you enjoy our content, please consider showing your support for the Society. If you have an interest in aerospace, find out about the professional and personal benefits that Society membership offers. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Hi, Mick Oakey here, Managing Editor of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. First off this time, I'd like to offer huge congratulations to Extended on its 100th episode. It's a real milestone, something for the team to be very proud of. And it's a great honour for me and my publication to be a small part of. When Peter Johnson kindly invited me to contribute a piece to this edition, he suggested that some reflective content and tone would be appropriate. So, rather than do my usual blathering on about what's in our latest issue, I did what aviation history people instinctively do, and started looking back in time. It occurred to me that I didn't actually know how long Extended had been going. I only came on board in 2014, I think. When I found that episode 1 aired in May 2012, I realised that that was 1 year almost to the day after Nick Stroud and I first conceived The Aviation Historian, over a shared gallon of Guinness in the Founders Arms pub by the River Thames at Southwark, right next to the Tate Modern. All the best adventures begin in a pub, of course. Okay, admittedly, it took us until October 2012 before we actually launched TAH, by which time Extended was about to release its seventh episode. but perhaps that reflects the complications of getting a print publication up and running. Clearly, that period around 8 years ago was a very creative one for TAH and Extended, and for quite a lot of cottage industry-type ventures sprouting up at that time, as we were emerging from the fallout of the 2008 financial crisis. And now, with COVID-19, we are smack back into another crisis, even worse this time, with the aviation industry reeling and the wheels coming off enterprises and whole economies the world over. During difficult times, almost all of us can take refuge in a sense of community, even if we can't spend time in person with distant family and friends. Aviation communities such as Extended's listeners and the Aviation Historian's readership are curious in a way, because their members often will never actually meet in person, or even be in direct contact with each other, online or by phone. But what links these communities is a shared passion, and thank goodness for that. So, how are these communities doing in a time of coronavirus? I can't really speak for podcasts such as Extended, although I imagine they've been doing pretty well during lockdown, when many people are stuck at home, eager for information, stimulation and entertainment. Looking back to before lockdown, for the magazine and newspaper industry, the past decade has brought seismic changes, with largely dwindling circulations and collapsing advertising revenues. But specialist titles such as the aviation magazines we all know and love, or hate, have tended to fare better. This is because many of them don't rely too heavily on selling ad space, and they have loyal readers and subscribers who, in many cases, have been with them for years or decades. The coronavirus pandemic has been having decidedly mixed effects, though. On the plus side, publications that can be bought via websites and have a high proportion of subscribers, that is, readers who receive their print issues by mail, have been doing pretty well. I'm pleased to say that TAH falls into that category, with print sales through our website up a massive 42% in April compared with last year, and up 57% in May so far, year on year. Of course, it could all go horribly wrong tomorrow, so please keep your fingers crossed for us. The picture is less rosy elsewhere, though. In France, Air Power magazine folded in mid-May, less than 4 years after its launch, citing a drastic fall in sales through newsagents because so many of them have been shut. In the UK, the general aviation magazine Flyer announced in early May that it was ditching its print edition and going digital only, again because of plummeting news trade sales. Others will doubtless follow. Although in the meantime, long-established title Pilot has picked up a good few new print subscribers as a result of Flyer's change of direction. And mainstream aviation history magazines such as Aeroplane, which I used to edit, and Flypast are combating the shortage of high street outlets by offering single print issues by post, including free delivery. On the face of it, you'd think this would be costing their publishers an arm and a leg. But actually, once you take into account the huge chunk of the cover price that normally goes to the newsagent, it's probably not much different. Still a bit of a logistical nightmare, though, I should think. The message in all this is, in a fast-changing world, cherish your favourite aviation magazines and podcasts. Take the time to savour them and make the most of them. And with that, it's goodbye for now from me, Mick Oakey at The Aviation Historian. And let's all raise a glass to Extended as it hits its century. Cheers!
Tim, you obviously are heavily involved in the industry. How's Aerospace Magazine faring in the current climate?
Well, I mean, we're pretty lucky in that we are a membership magazine of the society, so we don't have to chase subscriptions like the Aviation Historian. It comes with your membership, but I mean the industry is evolving, and you know the current situation. We've been lucky enough that we are able to do it remotely, which is pretty good. It does introduce some friction into the process, into the production process. So, you know, press week, you really, ideally, you'd have everybody in the office, and at least for the final couple of days, and you'd be there, able to swap ideas quickly. If you are remotely working and you are separated, it just takes longer. So that has been a change, and it's kind of something you just basically got to think ahead more and build in extra time for this kind of to exchange messages, you know, rather than just sort of shouting across the editorial room. You know, I miss that. I also miss you know, bouncing ideas off people quickly. I mean, obviously you can do it over Teams or Zoom or what have you, but it's having someone sat across you from the office and you're just going, hey, what do you think about this? It's far easier. But I mean, touch wood, you know, the magazine has we've still been able to get the print magazine out from the from our printers, so they've been great in doing the distribution. Actually we've upped our digital offerings with a new aerospace app for members, so we're actually increasing our communications channels, and that's happening across the rest of the Aeronautical Society as well. So weirdly, we're now reaching more people, if that makes sense. So for example, things like, you know, webinars, you know, some of the lectures have been turned into virtual webinars, and you know, a lecture where you'd think, oh, this is a really niche subject, you know, I don't think, you know, you'd go in there in the lecture theatre and it'd be like a quarter full, you know, in regular times. Now that there's 500 people signed up online to watch it. And you know, it's some kind of obscure subject. So that's really interesting. We've also been doing stuff on the you know, Journal of Aeronautical History. The library's got sort of new stuff out as well. So I wouldn't say it's like a kind of an opportunity or something. I think that's a bit sort of, but it's kind of pushed us more into, upgrading our, you know, things that we're always talking about going, oh, well, you know, wouldn't it be great if we had an app, you know, that's been going on for a while. And all of a sudden, oh, we need to go and reach out to people. Oh, let's fast track this app, you know? So that's,
and it's really good news to hear from Mick that the Aviation Historian is doing well. Obviously, you mentioned some publications that have gone by the wayside there. But, you know, through all adversity, sometimes opportunity comes. And I really do hope for the work and the effort that they put into that publication. I know Gareth has been reading it recently. It's stunning. So we wish them continued success in these troubling times.
Yeah.
Okay, so back in 2011, I produced a segment called Across the Pond on the Airplane Geeks podcast, and Tim and Gareth featured as my guests. That's how we got to meet. We couldn't contain the excitement about the industry, and of course we spun off that segment into what is now Extended. But I thought I'd go all the way back and chat to Max, Rob, David and Brian on a Zoom call to catch up about the impact of the current crisis in the States and get some advice from them on how to match their 600 podcast episode run. I started asking Max how many guests they'd featured.
I haven't added them up. And of course, we've had some repeat guests, as you have as well. Yeah.
Probably over 500.
Yeah,
probably,
I was just going to say,
must be people over 500. Because not every episode we've had guests, but probably over 500.
Yeah. Which, when you think of it, I mean, if you had to make a list right now of the next 500 people you wanted to have come on as a guest.
Yeah. Actually, Max, it's probably more than 500, because if you think about, like, every time we've done to an air show or something, that's three or four guests.
Multiple
interviews.
Guests, yeah.
Yep. Yeah, yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean,
how about learning a bit more about you all? Max, tell us a little bit about yourself. You are the podcaster of all aviation podcasts.
That's way too generous. I think that's way, way too generous.
I think it is, too.
Yeah. But, yeah, I had a long career at Pratt & Whitney, and towards the latter parts of that, I started Airplane Geeks podcast along with Courtney Miller, and those were different days. Those were, you know, working full-time and at nights producing the podcast, but it grew pretty quickly. It grew in terms of listeners. It grew in terms of hosts, co-hosts, and contributors, and participants, and all. And it kind of became this almost larger than life community in some ways.
Yeah. Yeah. How about you, Rob?
I spent most of my life as a professional pilot flying biz jets, but I'm also a writer. I'm currently senior editor at Flying Magazine. In case people actually go to the newsstand, if you can even find a newsstand anymore, I don't know if that's even possible. But let's see, Max, what did you say the first Airplane Geeks was?
It was in 2008, June 2008.
Okay, so in October of 2006, I started Jetwine the blog just because somebody I knew from Southwest Airlines said, "Oh, you ought to blog about the industry." I said, "Great. What's a blog?" So, I kind of got hooked on it. And one guy that works with me, Scott Spangler, who used to be the editor of Flight Training Magazine years ago before it was sold to AOPA, is the editor of Jetwine now, and he's been writing a lot. He thinks this is the coolest thing in the world, and I just kept saying, why screw up a good thing? you know, and when I post something, people go, "Oh, you posted something? What's your name again?" No, anyway. So I have been around the airplane industry most of my life, and this is a lot of fun for me. And I was asked to join Airplane Geeks back at episode, what, maybe 45 or 50 or something like that, I think. God, back in the old days when Courtney was still there, and we had Dan Webb, and I don't know,
Dan,
who else?
Gosh,
and I think I made it to episode 500, and then I realized it was time to hang up my headphones because Max told me I should. So I mean that had a lot to do with it. but anyway, it's been a lot of fun. And the one thing I've always enjoyed about what we're doing here and all the segments from all the contributors, I mean, Peter, you and Steve and Grant, and I mean, we always have such interesting people in our lives that we introduce the audience to that most likely they never would have had a way to meet or to hear if it hadn't been for I can't say us because I don't do a regular podcast, but you guys do. So, I mean, I think the industry is probably really grateful to you guys for that.
Yeah. Mm. How about you, David?
I'm the classically trained historian of the group. And I was listening to Airplane Geeks, and Max and Courtney said, "Well, we're looking for interesting things. Any suggestions?" And I made the mistake of writing a email saying they needed a history segment, and got an email back from this guy by the name of Max Flight, who said, "Great, we love the idea. When do you start writing it?" So I was sort of drafted into the show, and I sort of came in about the same time as Rob did. Rob started episode 50, and that actually was the episode that my first history segment was read. After a couple of months, the guys got sick of reading my history segments and said, "Okay, why don't you come on the show and do your history segment?" So I was like, you, Peter, I was doing a segment on the show, and then eventually they needed a military aircraft expert, so I got drafted in to start talking about tankers, and here we are.
Still talking about tankers.
We're still talking about tankers. I wrote history. Max and I have spun off another podcast talking about drones.
I've been on your show. I've been on Grant's show. I'm sort of everybody's go-to, like, if they need a fact check on history. So, but like Rob has said, we've had opportunities to meet so many people and build a community. And, you know, it's sort of amazing that if you told me when I started in 2009 that I would be doing this in 2020, I would have told you were completely nuts. So,
and maybe we all are.
Yeah, I think so.
But you just sort of, good times, bad times, you know, it's always there. It's a good thing. So,
yeah. And Brian
started off as a listener. So I found the show probably around episode 8 or 10 or 12. I don't know. Way back when, I probably said on the show what episode it actually was that I first started listening. It was certainly much easier then, going back and listening to them all. So being the completist that I am, I had to do that. I think like being a pilot, you either have time or you have money, but you don't have both. And I was listening to the show, I don't know, Max, when did I first write into you? Probably around episode 200, maybe 250,
something.
I don't
like
know.
That.
It was pretty far along, and I always wanted to contribute to the show, but I really didn't have any money to do that, but I had some time. So I wrote to Max saying, hey, I'd like to give back. What could I do? And he came up with the idea of me to be associate producer of the show. And I did that from whatever episode I started in the 200s through 513 was the show when I finally had some money, but not enough time any longer, and had to give that up. And sort of the element that I brought to the show, besides scheduling a lot of the guests, was on the side, I've flown over 5 million miles, which several years ago seemed like an awful lot to fly. These days, there are so many people that have over 10 million. The 5 million just sort of pales in comparison, but I've certainly had my fair share of commenting on United as them being my airline, not necessarily of choice, but airline that I have to fly on. So I've had a lot of maybe not so nice comments about United, but I think I've also tried to be fair and balanced over it, and that I've when they do things right, I've noted that. It just unfortunately I haven't had that much of an opportunity to talk about good things that they've done as opposed to the other. Yes, I have over 3 million miles on United, over 1 million on American, and the rest on everyone else.
Wow. So let me come back to Max. Max, you've produced and been involved in over 1,000 podcasts. You spun off, I was writing them down here. We've got the Airplane Geeks, we've got the UAV Digest, we've got the PaxX podcast, we've got PCDU, we've got News Talk, we've got Extended, and also programs like Plane Talk in UK and Carlos and the team. What have you seen change in the last decade or so?
Besides yourself. A few gray hairs here. Yeah.
We've all got those.
Yes, we do. Yeah, I think that from the podcast perspective, I think the podcasts these days, the episodes are a little more professionally produced, or they're a little bit more professional. When we started, all of us, we were just amateurs, right? We didn't barely know what we were doing. We were just kind of winging it and sort of experimenting with things. So I think that's changed over time. I think another thing that's happened over time is that each of those podcasts have created communities around them of really, really engaged listeners. And it's something that many other podcasts in other industries or of other types, they don't enjoy that same level of enthusiasm from the audience. I belong to and hang out in a couple of places where forums and societies and things where people who create podcasts hang out. And one of the most frequent things you hear is, how do I get my listeners to send me email. How do I get my listeners involved in the show? And I always kind of chuckle because none of us, including yourself, Peter, and the others, maybe it's just people who are aviation enthusiasts or professionals in the industry just like to get engaged. I don't know. Yeah. It's kind of remarkable.
Well, it's funny. I met Gareth and Tim on the show. It was part of one of our segments. I think we talked a couple of times, and that's how we just ran out of time to talk. And that's how I got to know them a little bit better. But of course, we got Stephen Grant as well. And without you guys, technically, I would have never got this going. I mean, even though I was saying earlier, I just plug a mic in, some headphones, and a recorder. Mix minus and all those other things, I just couldn't have done it without you guys. But I suppose just taking that point when we were talking off air earlier, we've had 200 odd guests. You've maybe had, I don't know, 600, 700, 800 guests. The reach into the aviation community is actually massive. I mean, I look at the guest list. I look at your guest list. I look at our guest list. And when anyone says to me, oh, what do you do in the evening? And I talk about the podcast. They say, oh, yeah, but, you know, who do you have on your show? And we say, well, astronauts, pilots, you know, all sorts of people. They're astounded. They're absolutely astounded. How do you feel the next stage of podcasting is going to reach into the communities? What do you think will come next? Because you run the aviation podcast directory on 30,000 feet on your own web server. I'm sending you now. I've got another two new podcasts come out this week, aviation podcasts. There must be 200, 300. How do you think the whole aviation podcasting community is going to shift in the coming decade, shall we say?
Well, a lot of competition, and I don't mean that as in terms of competing against, you know, one podcast versus another, but competition for listeners' time. In the earlier days, there were just a relatively small number of aviation podcasts. So if that's what you wanted to listen to, it was relatively easy to listen to all of them. Now there are increasing, and this is great because each one is different. Yeah. There are increasing numbers of aviation podcasts, and you can't listen to them all. There are too many. There are just too many. And that's true of other, genres of or topics of podcasts as well. It's not just specific to aviation, but it's becoming more difficult to compete for the time of the listeners. And so listeners can be more discerning about what they choose to listen to.
And we face very unusual times. We're in very, very unusual times at the moment. And we're seeing a lot of interest in some of the back catalog because people are got more time at home and that sort of thing. How's everyone coping? How are you guys coping with what's going on? How, and your links into the industry. How's it the industry coping stateside?
I think, at least for me and some of the folks that I work with at the magazine, I think it's pretty tough. Yeah. I must admit that for the first month, it was unique. And so I thought, well, this is going to be an adventure. By the second month, it was, okay, I've had enough adventure walking from one end of the backyard to the other. You can't go to a museum. You can't. I mean, there's a whole lot of can'ts. And you, I think, at least for me and some of my friends, we kind of took a lot of that for granted. For everybody to kind of grasp what they can or cannot do or should or shouldn't do. Yeah. I mean, I was out flying about a week and a half ago, and I hadn't flown in, when I was talking to Max West the other night, I think I said maybe 6 weeks or 7 weeks, and it just felt strange to be in an airplane. I mean, there's no one else out there but me, it was just odd. The traffic's down about 50 or 60% at our airport. We do GA airplanes, little ones and corporate jets, and the jets are still flying, but the small airplanes have been pretty much buttoned down. So I think we're still trying to figure out what happens next. I mean, we, of course, here in the States, we've canceled all of the big shows that bring people together to, you know, schmooze about airplanes and aviation and all the sundry supplies and gadgets that go along with it. I think that's been really hard because, again, I think a lot of the people on podcasts are a bit outgoing and they like chatting with other people. I came to get used to the interviews that, you know, Max would be somewhere, or David would be somewhere, or Brian would be somewhere, or, you know, whoever, and they'd say, well, we're going to interview today. We managed to catch, blah, 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 you know, and you'd hear 5 minutes of this and you go, oh, yeah, it's pretty cool. And we don't have that opportunity anymore at all. So, it again, when you tick off all the boxes, there's a lot of stuff that we're missing.
And David, you work in a museum. What sort of effect is it having on the museum industry over in the States?
Well, we actually, because of Pennsylvania's regulations, I'm at the American Helicopter Museum, and I'm the retail manager there. We, on the 18th of March, due to the shutdown, I mean, we closed, we shuttered our doors. We're not scheduled to reopen. At this point, we're working a close to July opening. And then the question is, okay, how are we going to open? Now, it's a hangar. It's a very large hangar. But there are regulations being set up and recommendations being set up about social distancing. And at right now, the regulation will be we're only allowed to have 25% of our people in. We've had three major events at the museum that were our major fundraisers that are gone. Yeah. They're completely wiped out and may or may not be replaced. The other part about our museum specifically is a lot of revenue comes from rental spaces. We rent out the museum for parties and for weddings and charity events. You can't have anybody more than 10 people in an event.
Yeah.
So we've lost, the museum itself has probably lost 80% of its revenue for the year, which is kind of devastating. And then once we do open up, the question is who's going to come back. I mean, we're an education center. We're geared towards younger children, but you can't have younger children running around playing together, you know, and so our play area, we're probably going to have to shut down. I mean, exhibits are going to have to change. You're not going to be able to, you know, some of the interactive exhibits, you're not going to be able to set up until we get a vaccine because you can't have people touching them because you're not going to be able to have somebody following somebody around with sanitizer, wiping them down after every time someone climbs into a helicopter or an airplane.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a world of change for the museum industry, not just my museum, but every museum is going to have to, like restaurants and like everything else, there's going to be a giant rethink on how you do things, how you interact with people. It's going to be tough. I know that my supplies and the gift shop will have to change dramatically because a lot of the product isn't coming in.
Yeah.
Because it's being shipped from overseas. So we've got a lot of challenges ahead to, you know, and I'm afraid, like everything else, a lot of museums are going to fail because they're not going to be able to keep up with what's going on. When you lose major core pieces of revenue, it's tough. We only have a staff of 7 people, technically. The rest of it's all volunteers. But in our case, all of our volunteers are Boeing Vertol and Sikorsky. They're senior citizens. They're volunteers. They're in their 60s and 70s. Even our volunteer base, they're high-risk individuals, you know, and we love them dearly, but you don't want to put them in jeopardy. It's going to be, when we do open back up, it's going to be a different experience.
And Brian, have you flown through any of this?
No, not. Certainly, I haven't flown since January, and it's kind of a shame because I had a trip planned to England, to Germany, to Italy, and it all got canceled.
Yeah.
So that was very disappointing.
Have you guys seen the same pictures we've seen over here of flights packed? I mean, there was an example of an Aer Lingus flight in Europe, three abreast, you know, a single aisle, three abreast, full. No.
I think that's really an exception over here. I was just reading an article this morning where United said that it was something like 32% of all of the flights that they're flying have less than 10 people on board. They now have more pilots than they do passengers on a daily basis.
Wow.
So yeah, it's a real mess over here. There's the occasional story where you do get a full flight, but I think that's really an exception. Rather than, I was looking the other day at loads going from San Francisco to Tokyo and to Singapore and Sydney. Maybe not the best places to pick, but more or less the aircraft had 45-50 business class seats, and only 16 of them were assigned.
Right. Wow.
Now, that's not saying that they haven't sold more and just the seats weren't assigned, but oftentimes when looking at seat maps, if whatever's there, people don't show.
Yeah.
So I think that the loads are about that full right now. And again, yeah, it's really unfortunate.
Yeah. Sad times. So what else is going on? What's the pipeline looking like, Max? I mean, one of the great things that we've got is we're not weekly, so there's a bit less pressure on us to produce content, but we're very feature rich and we've got just such a big backlog of areas to cover and guests and things like that, even in these times when there's no flying. How are things fixed for you? What can we look forward to?
Well, I hope not too many more conversations about the pandemic. It's really, I mentioned this in the last episode, it's really, really hard for our news segment to not focus in on that because everything is revolving around that.
Yeah. So we're just heading to 100. You guys are at 600. What advice have you got for us to keep going?
quit while you're ahead.
It'll take us 64 years to get to 600, I think, if my maths is right, something like that.
Yeah. It's like the Alcoholics Anonymous program, you know, one day at a time, you know, one episode at a time, just keep plugging away.
Okay. Listen, guys, appreciate your time. It's great to see you all, although Rob's disappeared.
He has, hasn't he? And of course, Peter, we want to really congratulate you on this terrific milestone of a 100 episodes. It's really quite remarkable, the amount of the content that you've put out and the guests and the stories and the information, the history, all of the things that have been just
thanks, Max.
A joy to listen to.
That's really kind. We almost didn't make it. I almost threw the towel in, Brian.
I was going to say, and Peter, it's also important to note that we appreciate your friendship, and at some point we're all going to get together and have a beer.
Yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely. And it's great to see you all. And I know there's been this mystery about whether I really did exist or not. But I'm not artificial. Listen, guys, thanks so much for your time today.
Really, this was really fun.
Appreciate it.
It was fun, Peter.
We'll do it again.
Peter, congratulations on.
Yeah, thanks very much. Listen, be safe.
G'day. I'm Dave Homewood, of the Wings Over New Zealand show, New Zealand's only regular aviation podcast series. The Wings Over New Zealand show covers all sorts of aviation topics, with a New Zealand flavour but an international appeal. From interviews with veterans and aviation personalities, to topics like military aviation, warbirds, air shows, historians, authors, museums, aviation events, and much, much more. We have an extensive archive of episodes that you can go back to, and there are new episodes coming out all the time. Search for the Wings Over New Zealand show. Oh, and by the way, we love Extended. It's a great show. Well done, guys.
I also want to give a mention to Steve Vischer and Grant McCarran, who make up the Airplane Geeks family, when they produced the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast. If you've not listened to that, a lot of the content there is still online, and it's not date sensitive. I just want to make that mention, because Steve was a massive help in helping us to get Extended up and running. So a big thanks to Steve Vischer Down Under.
Yeah, thanks, Steve.
Yeah, let's think about the next 8 years. We talked about some ideas for guests coming up, and we're always open to ideas from our listeners, by the way. How do we see the industry shifting in the next 8 years? Gareth, let me start with you.
I mean, where to begin? I mean, you know, I have a lot of fears for the aviation industry, I think. You know, certainly in the short term and medium term, it's looking commercially, you know, it's looking grim. And, I don't know if anyone really can put their hand on their heart and predict what's going to happen. You know, I think we have to just hope from a commercial point of view that things can get up and running as soon as possible, however long that is going to be, and that maybe slowly and surely things will start to return to some sense of normality. But I did see a quote, it might have been from Virgin, saying they think it'll be at least 3 years maybe before flight levels are back to anything what they were like in 2019. So yeah, militarily I think it's going to be interesting. I mean, just the onset, the constant onset of technology, I think, obviously particularly unmanned vehicles, etc., that's undoubtedly going to come to the fore. But I'm also hoping we're going to get to see some new aircraft emerging, maybe from the shadows in America. That would be something I would love to see. That would be very exciting, I think. And if I just jump back to commercially a second, you know, I was due to fly on a 747 in September on Virgin, and that's not going to happen. And I have to say, that makes me really, really sad.
Yeah.
And it does look like the era of the four engine commercial jet is could be coming to an end.
Yeah, the four holers are gone. The three holers are hanging in there on the cargo front, but I think they've short-lived as well.
I was just going to say, Tim, I think, did you tweet that picture yesterday of a A380 that somebody had painted in US Air Force?
Yes, I saw that.
Yeah, that's gone out of a very, very popular for some reason. I mean, that was somebody who did that back in 2011.
Oh, was it?
All right, okay.
And it's a French site with people, somebody doing sort of, you know, a fabulous what if type aircraft. And he'd done this as a sort of, you know, EADS, you know, what if, you know, they had the C-48 or so, or C-58 sort of transport. And I think some people sort of thought it was real.
Yeah. The graphics were pretty impressive, I've got to say. For a second, I was like, wow, that's quite cool, actually. But to staying on military aviation, Tim, what's the current thinking on the Tempest? Where do you think that will go in the next few years? Are we likely to see that development accelerate, or is it just going to fall on its rear end?
So the problem is, I think, is so defence on the one hand has been insulated from what's happening in the somewhat of what's happening in the commercial world. So people are still building fighters. People are still saber rattling in various parts of the earth, world. So there's still that requirement. However, what it has done is the whole bailouts and economic damage is going to drive a coach and horses through anyone's estimates of what happens with military budgets around the world. Even the US, by the time all this is sort of settled, getting Sweden, getting Italy involved with Tempest was probably, you know, a good move, turning into sort of like a international sort of program, or at least being led by the UK. But I think there's going to be some hard choices ahead in terms of the defence budget, of what can we possibly cut now? You know, if we're having a bailout for, you know, basically the whole economy, defence is going to take a hit. You know, and funding, as one might imagine, funding for the NHS, that's going to be secure, probably end up being boosted. Defense less so. So what is going to happen there, and what's going to get cut, and is that going to push Tempest rightwards, possibly, or some capabilities going to get cut nearer term that we've already got? Not sure.
Okay. Well, listen, let's take a quick break and then we'll look at some promoting aerospace.
Event Fire Solutions is an independent fire and rescue service providing both preventative and reactive emergency services across the UK. As well as our main event management, we provide the support and equipment to deliver a safe and risk-free event. From fire appliances to medical vehicles, our fully trained and accredited staff will make your event a true success. If you need risk-related advice, investigation, medical or fire training, then we can deliver this for you. From the office to the airfield, we have the experience and the accreditation, and most of all, the skills to make your workplace event safe and risk-free. To find out more of how we can help you, look us up at eventfiresolutions.co.uk.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
Okay, over to promoting aerospace. Tim, I thought it would be really useful to mention the new media library that the Society has just launched. What an amazing amount of unseen footage they're just about to release.
So that's the Heritage Film Archive.
Yeah,
I mean that's great. So that's some really rare stuff in. So that's the National Aerospace Library, which is based down in Farnborough. They've got all these, they've had all these sort of films and stuff there that have been laying about unseen. I mean, there was one I looked at the other day that was sort of laying unseen for 80 years, and it had been first shown by the founder of Douglas Aircraft when he came to give a lecture in the Society in 1935. It was basically the early history of the US air transport system. So some really rare stuff like there, Miles aircraft, weird and wonderful US Army Army helicopters in 1944 that you've never heard of. And it's like, what the heck happened to those?
Yeah.
So really, really interesting stuff to see and sort of heritage and weird stuff.
I'll put a link in the notes to the library. There is a pretty easy link to remember though. It's aerosociety.com/movies, and there are at least 30 films that have not been watched in over 50 or 60 years, apparently. So Brian was saying to me, and there's everything from Charles Lindbergh to Croydon Airport in the early days. So there's some really fantastic stuff there. So in these times when you may have an hour or two with nothing to do, go over and have a look at that. Any other shout-outs, chaps?
Not so much promoting aerospace, but I thought the link with Bondi and the Red Arrows, I thought it would be nice for us just to mention the Canadian Forces Snowbirds, who on May the 17th had a terrible accident with one of their Tutor, CT-114 Tutor aircraft. And Jen Casey, who is the public affairs officer, who some people will know because she looked after the NORAD schemed F-18 solo display aircraft that came over to the UK. Unfortunately, she lost her life. So thoughts with everybody from the Royal Canadian Air Force and obviously her family and friends. Absolutely tragic.
Yeah, that's well worth mention. Thanks for that, Gareth. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. There was one last shout out. So just came up, actually popped up today. And this is from Airability, so disabled flying charity. And, you know, we all the aviation enthusiasts around the world have been facing, you know, air shows have been cancelled. You know, Riyadh, Farnborough, Duxford, you know, so everyone's been sort of stuck at home and you know, kind of going stir crazy. Airability are doing an armchair air show on 20th of June, and they're getting Mike Ling from the Blades, ex Red One, to I think commentate or run the show. And so that's something to look at for in next month of previously unseen air display footage in Coppola cameras, pilot commentary. And it's going to be on. It's going to be streamed on YouTube. So Armchair Air Show 2020. You know, I think that's worth a good worth a
great idea.
Yeah, that is. That is. And that's where we're going to ask a favour of you, because we don't have much feedback on the programme, and we've got to 100 episodes, and we really, really want to hear from you. We do get regular emails of support, but sadly, we get very few formal feedback messages. Unfortunately, some people are quick enough to complain, and whilst we do this all at our own expense and at our own time, and we know who I'm talking about more recently, it would be really good if some of you who have been on this journey with us, whether it's just for a short time or sadly for some like Neil Braden, the full 100 episodes, we do need your support. So please do leave us reviews on your podcast player or on our Facebook page. That would be gratefully appreciated. Really would.
Tell us what you'd like to hear and what you'd like us to talk about, and we'll see if we can make it happen. No promises, obviously.
But, no, we'll just ignore you, you know, and carry on as normal. No, it'd be great. Yeah, be great to hear.
What we want
to
do.
Yeah. Be great to hear. We've got some interesting episodes in the pipeline. The Cold War has always been popular, so we've got some bits and pieces on that. We are on a journey to help promote STEM, and particularly to attract more women into the sector. So we'll have some more exciting content from some role models there as well. But would love to hear from you. But we'd also like to say a big thank you to the people who supported the show. You hear every single episode. That's White Hearts and, of course, Peter Dixon. And as I said earlier, a big thank you to Mick Oakey and the team at the Aviation Historian, because they help promote the programme in the printed media. Also, a little mention to go back to Tony Whiting at Event Fire Solutions for his support over the years. Some of the equipment we're using to record this show was provided to us by Tony and the team at EFS. So thanks very much for that.
Thanks, Tony.
Yeah, real big shout out. He's been a great supporter over the years.
Yeah, definitely.
Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The program is produced with a Creative Commons license. So, Tim, whereabouts can we find you?
Right, I'm tweeting on RAS @TimR. at RASTMR, and you can find the Royal Aeronautical Society at aerosociety.com.
And we've said it before, if you don't follow Tim on Twitter, you're missing out. Gareth, where can we find you?
Yeah, there's all manner of made-up aircraft on his Twitter feed.
Yeah, yeah.
Next week will be an RAF 747. Yeah. I'm on Twitter as Gareth_Stringer, and everything for GAR is at globalaviationresource.com.
And you can find me, I'm Peter Johnson. You can find me at NASCOT Hornet on Twitter. And you can, of course, find Extended on our Facebook page, and we have a Twitter feed as well. So that's it, 100 episodes. Looking forward to the next 100. Yeah, well done all round.
Yay.
Exciting. So with the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Tim Robinson.
Goodbye all. See you next time.
And it's goodbye from Gareth Stringer.
Goodbye, everyone. Thanks for all your support.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
The cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
Just taking me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course,
Hey!
That'll teach me for looking at the clock.
Times.
Do you know what? I looked at the clock to see if we were on time. I'll do that bit again. And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. You can't get it out now. I can't do it now. Right.
Extend it.
This is XTP Media.